seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice, and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you.
The Sermon on the Mount opens with the Eighth Beatitude, one of the best-known sections of the Bible. Even people whose knowledge of the Scriptures is limited have heard of these Beatitudes. However, they hardly ever understand them, and as a rule regard them as a counsel of perfection without any real application. But this is only because they lack the spiritual key, which is the knowledge of how to apply the Scriptures from the spiritual level to everyday life. The Beatitudes are actually a prose poem in 8 verses, which is complete in itself and constitutes a general summary of the whole Christian teaching. It is a spiritual, more than a literary, synopsis, summarizing the spirit of the teaching rather than in literal words. This general summing up is highly characteristic of the ancient Oriental approach to religious and philosophical teaching, and naturally recalls the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, the 10 Commandments of Moses, and other concise groups of ideas.
Jesus concerned himself exclusively with the teaching of general principles, and these general principles always had to do with mental states. For he knew that if one's mental states are right, everything else must be right also. Yet, if these are wrong, nothing else can be right. Unlike other great religious teachers, he gives us no detailed instructions about what we are to do or not to do. He does not tell us either to eat or to drink or to refrain from eating or drinking during specific times or certain seasons. The whole point of his teaching is anti-ritualistic. A conscientious Pharisee of those days, and most of them were extremely conscientious, had approximately 600 outer detailed observances or rituals to attend every day before he could feel that he had satisfied the requirements of God. As it is obvious that no human being could actually carry out this sort of thing in practice, the natural result would be that the victim, conscious of falling far short of the accomplishments of his duties, must necessarily labor under a chronic sense of guilt or sin. Now, to believe yourself to be sinful is, for all practical purposes, to be sinful, with all the consequences that follow. The policy of Jesus is to wean the heart from relying upon outer things at all, either for pleasurable gratification or for spiritual salvation, and to incorporate a new attitude of mind altogether. And this policy is graphically set forth in the Beatitudes. Jesus also made us aware that how we worship God has nothing to do with physically where we are.
The hour cometh, when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. The hour cometh, and now is when the true worshipper shall worship the Father in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is the Spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
Your church, your temple, your place of worship, your secret place of Most High is with you at all times. Now let's examine and reacquaint ourselves with the simple and profound statements known as the Beatitudes.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
In order to understand what Jesus meant by poor in spirit, we have to take into account a point of great practical importance in the study of the Bible. It is written in a peculiar language of its own, in that terms and expressions and sometimes actual words are used in the Bible in a sense that is distinctly different from that of everyday usage. The Bible is really a textbook of metaphysics, a manual for the growth of the soul, and it looks at all questions from this point of view. Remember, in every sense of the word, it takes the broadest view of every subject. It sees all things in their relationship to the human soul, and it uses many common terms in a far broader sense than their everyday meaning. For example, the word bread in the Bible means not merely any kind of physical food, but all things that man requires. All physical things such as clothing, shelter, money, education, companionship, and so forth. And in relationship to the soul, it stands for spiritual perception, spiritual understanding, and ultimately spiritual realization. Give us this day our daily bread. I am the bread of life. Unless ye eat this bread. These are examples of the many uses of just one word. Another example is the word prosperity. In the scriptural sense, prosperity and prosper mean a great deal more than the acquisition of material possessions. Prosperity means success in prayer. From the point of view of the soul, success in prayer is the only kind of prosperity worth having. And if our prayers are successful, we shall naturally have all the material things that we need. A certain quantity of material goods is essential on this plane, of course, but material wealth, by itself, is really the least important thing in life. And this the Bible implies by giving the word prosperous its true meaning, success in prayer.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
So to be poor in spirit does not in the least mean the thing we call poor-spirited today. To be poor in spirit means to have emptied yourself of all desire to exercise personal self-will, and to have renounced all preconceived opinions in the wholehearted search of God. It means to be willing to set aside your present habits of thought, your present views and prejudices, your present way of life if necessary, to eliminate, in fact, anything and everything that can stand in the way of finding God. We can reject the guidance that Jesus offers us, reject our chance of finding God, because we are bound by our possessions. And even those who have no material wealth are bound by their own set of great possessions in the way of preconceived ideas, such as self-satisfaction or reliance upon the way that is familiar or easy, or great possessions of spiritual pride born of intellectual distinction. We even have sentimental or material attachments to institutions, organizations, and relationships, and habits of life that we have no desire to renounce. When the image of ourselves is measured by the world of possessions and attachments, we will always be grounded and seemingly apart from God. Wealth in itself is neither good nor bad, but love of money, the Bible tells us, is the root of all evil.
To be poor in spirit means we can all be multimillionaires in silver and gold. We can have possessions of learning, possessions of public honor and importance. But as long as our hearts are not set upon having these things, we are as free of material attachments as the poorest beggar to enter the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit have overcome the love of money and property, the fear of public opinion and the disapproval of relatives and friends. They are no longer overawed by human authority. They are no longer self-satisfied on their own opinions. They have come to see that their most cherished beliefs may have been, and probably were, mistaken, and that all their ideas and views of life may be false and indeed need changing. The poor in spirit are ready to continuously re-examine their lives and learn to live in the kingdom of heaven every day.
Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted.
Mourning or sorrow is not in itself a good thing.
For the will of God is that everyone should experience happiness and joyous success. Jesus says, I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. Nevertheless, trouble and suffering are often extremely useful, because many people will not bother to learn the truth until driven to do so by sorrow and failure. Sorrow then becomes a relatively good thing. Sooner or later, every human being will discover the truth about God and make their contact with Him at first hand. Sooner or later, we will all have to acquire the understanding of truth, which will set us free once and for all from our three-dimensional limitations and their end results, sin, sickness, and death. But most people won't undertake the search for God wholeheartedly unless driven there by trouble of some kind. There is really no need to have trouble if we only seek God first. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, then the trouble need never come. We always have the choice of learning by spiritual unfoldment or of learning by painful experience. As a rule, it's only when health is broken down and ordinary medical means have failed to afford relief that people seriously set about gaining that spiritual understanding of their body as the true embodiment of divine life. And this is our only guarantee of overcoming sickness and ultimately death. If we could turn to God for this understanding while our health is still good, we need never be sick at all. Again, it's usually only when people are feeling the pinch of poverty, that is when ordinary material sources of supply have dried up, that they turn to God as a last resort and learn the lesson that the divine power really is the source of man's supply, and all material agents are merely the channels.
Now, this is the lesson to be learned and thoroughly realized before man can pass on to any experience higher or wider than the present one. In our Father's house are many mansions, but the key to higher mansions is always acquiring complete dominion over the one we are in now. If prosperous people will, while they are still prosperous, acknowledge God as their true source and pray daily for still more spiritual understanding, they need never suffer poverty or financial trouble at all. At the same time, they must be careful to use their present resources well, not hoarding riches selfishly or spending foolishly, but recognizing that God is the owner, and that they are only the stewards or trustees for him. The command of money involves a responsibility which one cannot evade. Dispense it wisely or be prepared to learn some lessons. This general principle applies to every one of our difficulties, not merely physical or financial troubles, but all the other ills to which the flesh is heir. Family troubles, quarrels with friends, sadness, and all the rest need never come if we will seek first the kingdom of God and right understanding. But if we look in another direction for our source of power, then the troubles of life will become our own. And then this sadness will be a blessing in disguise, for through it we shall be comforted. And by comfort, the Bible means the experience of the presence of God, which is the end of all sadness.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
On the surface, this beatitude seems to have very little validity and seems to be obviously contradicted by the plain facts of everyday life. No sensible person looking about the world or studying history could sincerely accept this saying as its face value, and most honest Christians have passed it by in practice with a regretful feeling that no doubt that is how things ought to be. But realize things aren't that way in real life. The fact is that when correctly understood, the teaching of Jesus is found to be not only true, but exceedingly practical and of value to every situation, every day of our lives. We find then that he was no sentimental dreamer, no mere dealer in empty platitudes, but the unflinching realist that only a great mystic can be. And the whole essence of his teaching and of his practical application is summed up in this beatitude.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
When you possess the spiritual meaning of this statement, you have the secret of dominion, the secret of overcoming every kind of difficulty. It is literally the key of life. It is the Jesus Christ message reduced to a single sentence.
The words meek and earth are both used in a special and highly technical sense, and they have to be unveiled before the wonderful meaning that underlies them can be found. First of all, the word earth in the Bible does not mean merely this terrestrial globe. It really means manifestation. Manifestation or expression is the result of a cause. A cause has to be expressed or manifested before we can know anything about it. And yet every expression or manifestation has to have a cause. Now we learn in divine metaphysics, and particularly in the Sermon on the Mount, that all causation is mental, and that our body and all our affairs, our home, our business, our personal relationships, all our experiences are the expression of our own mental states. The fact that we are unconscious of most of our mental states doesn't change anything, because the thoughts are there in our subconscious mind and still create or cause our lives to turn out the way they do. Our earth means the whole of our outer experience. And to inherit the earth means to have dominion over that outer experience. That is to say, to have power to bring our conditions of life into harmony and true success. All the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. His soul shall dwell at ease, and his seed or prayers shall inherit the earth. The Lord reigneth, let the earth rejoice. So we see that when the Bible talks about the earth, possessing the earth, governing the earth, making the earth glorious, and so forth, it is referring to the conditions of our lives, from our bodily health outwards to the effect our life has on others. So this beatitude undertakes to tell us how we may possess, govern, and be masters of our own lives and destinies. Dominion, that is, power over the conditions of our lives, is obtained in a certain way, and in the most unexpected of all ways, by meekness. The word meekness is also used in a special and technical sense. Its true significance has nothing in common with the meaning it bears in modern English. Many unpleasant qualities in human nature are associated with the meek, suggesting weakness, lack of courage, and self-respect, of no use to oneself or to anyone else. The true significance of the word meek in the Bible is a mental attitude for which there is no single word available, and it's this mental attitude which is the secret of prosperity or success in prayer. It's a combination of open-mindedness, faith in God, and the realization that the will of God for us is always something joyous and interesting and vital, and far better than anything we could think of for ourselves. This state of mind inspires a perfect condition to allow this will of God to come about in whatever way divine wisdom considers to be best, rather than in some particular way that we have chosen for ourselves.
This mental attitude, perhaps complex in analysis, but simple in itself, is the key to dominion or success in prayer. There is no one word for it in common speech, but if we desire to inherit the earth, we must absolutely acquire this meekness. There is a familiar phrase, as meek as Moses, resulting from his extraordinary success in prayer. The example of his life influenced the whole subsequent course of history by his teaching and his deeds. Moses had an open mind, ready to be taught new things and new ways of thinking and working. He didn't reject fresh ideas because they were revolutionary. Like all of us, he wasn't free from faults of character, but he was too aware for intellectual or spiritual pride, and therefore gradually rose above his faults as the new truth worked in his soul. Moses thoroughly understood that to conform completely to the will of God didn't involve any loss or risk, and could only mean a finer and better and more splendid life. He didn't think of it as self-sacrifice, for he knew it to be the highest form of self-glorification in the true and wonderful sense of the word. The self-glorification of the egotist is the vanity that always leads to humiliation. True self-glorification, the glorification that is really glorious, is the glorification of God. The Father in me, he doeth the works. I in thee, and thou in me. Realization of this state of mind and state of being called meekness is the key of life, the secret of overcoming every difficulty in life, the way to inherit the earth.
In the Bible that sums up in a few words the whole philosophy of religion. As usual in the scriptures, the words are used in a technical sense and cover a far wider meaning than we attach to them in everyday life. Consider the promise in this beatitude. It is nothing less than to see God. Now we know, of course, that God has no earthly form, and therefore there is no question of seeing him in the ordinary physical sense, in which one might see a human being or object. If one could see God in this way, then God would have to be limited and therefore not God. To see in this sense refers to spiritual perception, and spiritual perception means the capacity to experience the true nature of being. We live in God's world, and heaven lies all about us. It's not a distant locality far off in space and time, but all around us now. When we think of God's world as separate from us, then we are unable to experience it, and we think we are shut out of heaven. Heaven is the name for the presence of God. As God is infinite, so is heaven. Heaven is the realm of spirit, substance without age or discord or decay. Yet at times, to our earthly view, everything is aging, decaying, wearing out, getting born only to die, blossoming only to fade. But we are only seeing one phase or a partial picture of what is happening. Heaven is eternity, but what we know here on earth, we know only as a sequence called time, which never permits us to comprehend an experience in its entirety. We see everything distributed in what we call space, which continually inhibits the necessary regrouping of our experiences in order to know where we are. Our mental habits lead us to mold our experience into limited dimensions only.
We are often like a colorblind person in a beautiful flower garden. All around us are beautiful, glorious colors, but we can only see in black and white. There is so much beauty all around us if we could only see it. This limitation, known in theology as the fall of man, results from using our free will in opposition to the will of God. God is divine mind, and in that mind are no limitations or restrictions at all. Our goal is to rise above these perceived limitations until we can see things as they really are. To see God is to understand truth as it really is, and that is infinite freedom and perfect bliss.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
In this beatitude, we are told exactly how this supreme task is to be accomplished and who shall do it, the pure in heart. Again, we have to understand that here the words pure and purity in the Bible mean a very great deal more than physical purity. In its full and complete sense, purity is recognizing God alone as the only real cause and the only real power in existence. It is what is called elsewhere in the sermon, the single eye, and it is the master key to life. It is the secret of escape from all sickness, trouble, and limitation, and overcoming or reversing of the fall of man. The word heart in the Bible usually means that part of man's mentality which modern psychology knows under the name of subconscious mind. Heart is a subconscious mind. This is exceedingly important because it's not sufficient, nor is it possible for us to accept the truth with the conscious mind only. At that stage, it is still an opinion. It's not until it is accepted by the subconscious mind, and thus assimilated into the whole mentality, that it can make any difference in one's character or life. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Many people have intellectual or head knowledge of the presence of God, but this is external. We need to live with the presence of God in our hearts. Blessed are they who recognize God as the only real cause, the only real presence and the only real power, not merely in a theoretical or formal way, but practically and specifically and wholeheartedly, in all their thoughts and words and actions. And not merely in some parts of their lives, but in every nook and corner of their lives and mentalities, keeping nothing back, but bringing their own wills into perfect harmony with God's will. For they shall overcome all limitation of time and space and matter and carnal mind to realize and enjoy the presence of God forever. God is the only power.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God.
Here we receive an invaluable practical lesson in the art of prayer, and prayer is our only means of communion with God. As a matter of fact, prayer is the only real action in the full sense of the word, because prayer is the only thing that changes one's character. A change in character or a change in soul is a real change. When that kind of change takes place, you become a different person, and therefore, for the rest of your life, you think and act in a different way. Jesus referred to this change as being born again. In other words, you become a different person. The amount of the difference may be only very slight for each time that you pray. Nevertheless, the change is there, for you cannot pray without making yourself different in some degree. The word prayer should be understood as including any form of communion or attempted communion with God, whether vocal or purely mental.
In the absence of prayer, all that you can do is to express the character that you have in whatever circumstances you find yourself. Prayer changes your character, making a new reaction possible.
The great essential for success in prayer, for obtaining that sense of the presence of God, which is the secret of healing oneself and others too, of obtaining inspiration, which is the breadth of the soul, of acquiring spiritual development. The great essential for success in prayer is that we first attain some degree of true peace of mind. This true interior soul peace was known to the mystics as serenity, and serenity is the grand passport to the presence of God. The sea as smooth as glass that is round about the great white throne. However, we can overcome even the most serious difficulties by prayer without having any serenity at all. In fact, the greater the trouble we face, the less serenity we are able to have. And the serenity itself is only to be had by prayer, and by the forgiving of others, and of oneself. So prayer is always the answer. But serenity is necessary for spiritual progress, and it is serenity, that fundamental tranquility of soul, the peace that passes all human understanding.
Experience the peace of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God.
The peacemakers, spoken of in this beatitude, are those who make or bring about this true peace or serenity in their own souls. For it is they who surmount limitation and become actual and not merely potentially the children of God. This condition of mind is the objective of Jesus in all his instructions. Peace I leave with you, my peace I gave unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. To be a peacemaker, in the usual sense of settling the quarrels of other people, is, as all practical people know, an excessively difficult role to fill. By interfering in other people's strife, it's ever so much easier to make things worse than to make them better. Personal opinion is almost certain to enter into our efforts, and personal opinion is very likely to be wrong. Once we incorporate the power of prayer, many quarrels heal in the true way, probably without speaking at all. The silent thought of the all-power of love and wisdom will cause any trouble to melt away.
Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely, for my sake. Rejoice, and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you.
In view of what we know about the essential character of the teaching of Jesus, that the will of God for us is harmony, peace, and joy, and that these things are to be attained by cultivating right thoughts or righteousness, then this beatitude is a very controversial statement. Jesus tells us again and again that it is our Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom, and that the way in which we are to receive it is by cultivating serenity or peace of soul. He says that the peacemakers who do this, praying in meekness, shall obtain prosperity, inherit the earth, have their sadness turned into joy. And that, in fact, whatever they shall ask the Father, in the manner of this teaching, will be fulfilled. Yet here we're told that it is blessed to be persecuted as the result of our right thinking or righteousness, and by these means we shall triumph. That it is cause for rejoicing and gladness to be reviled and accused, and that the prophets and the great enlightened ones suffered these things too. All this is perfectly correct. Only we have to understand that the source of all this persecution is none other than our own selves. No outside persecutor, but only our own lower selves. When we find righteousness or right thinking very difficult, When we are very strongly tempted to hold the wrong thoughts about some situation or some person or about ourselves, or to give way to fear or anger or despondency, then we are being persecuted for righteousness' sake. And this is, for us, an extremely fortunate or blessed condition, for in such moments we are really advancing. Every spiritual treatment or scientific prayer involves a struggle with our lower self, indulging the old habit of negative thought, keeping the familiar and resisting change. All the great prophets and enlightened ones, even Jesus, overcame by just such struggles with themselves, persecuted by their own lower natures. Now, since these battles with the lower self have to be fought out sooner or later, then the sooner they are over and done with, the better. And so, they are great blessings by keeping us on the path to God. There is no virtue or advantage whatever in being persecuted or annoyed by other people. Nothing can come into our experience unless it finds something in us with which it is attuned. And so, to have trouble and difficulty is only a sign that our own mentality needs clearing up. For what we see at any time is nothing but our own concept. Some feel inclined to claim that they are being persecuted on account of their spiritual superiority. Some prefer the heroic self-sacrifice of the martyr. But their understanding is incomplete, or they wouldn't feel persecuted. If you fix your attention on superiority or martyrdom, regarding it as the highest good, you will, as with anything upon which you fix your attention, tend to bring it to yourself. In the great law of life, which the Sermon on the Mount explains, we can get only what belongs to us at any time. And no one can prevent our getting that. And so all persecution and hindrance are absolutely from within.
For what you see at any time is nothing but your own concept.
This concludes Side 2 of Living Outside Life's Struggles. Thank you for listening.